The first step in dealing with stress is to stop focusing on your problem and begin focusing on God.
Well, that was Max Lucado, who apparently, despite writing 12 million books, actually struggles with anxiety himself. So we'll be hearing more from him coming up in that segment where he talks about his book, Anxious for Nothing. We will also have our inbox segment. I get a chance to answer a girl who is starting to date online. And when she sees that guys are divorced, she's not sure how to ask them the reason for the divorce. This week's show sponsor is actually Evidence That Demands a Verdict, the new updated version written by father and son Josh and Sean McDowell, completely updated to speak truth to today's generation. You can get a free chapter at readevidencechapter.com. That's readevidencechapter.com. Well, here we are for a round table, and we have got Jake, Brandon, and Catherine here. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey. What'd it do?
Great to have you. All right. We are going to talk about worry today. But
been really anxious about this one.
Very. Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting because we had come across an article that actually makes the case for some worry being good. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But what first off, I need a temp check here. Who generally considers themselves more of a worrier than not? Or can you think of anything straight off the bat that you tend to worry about?
I'm a worrier, only in a very specific area, and I don't know if I've talked about it on this show or not.
Well, now you're going to.
But, guys, I grew up, I was exposed to a lot of eschatological theology as a child, very early, too early. And so I have spent the better part of two decades trying to figure out what the heck is going on with all this eschatology stuff, because there are so many opinions, and it freaked me out when I first ran into it as a kid. And I've spent the last, almost two decades trying to figure out how to save my soul from, the day of the Lord.
Well, please define eschatology just for those who may
know. Oh, yeah, sorry. Otherwise known as the end times. Eschatology is the study of the end of the world as we know it. And so the study of Revelation or Daniel or all the prophecies about who, what, when, where, and why, and so many different interpretations of that. And those freaked me out as a kid, and I'm still digging my way out from underneath all that stuff.
Okay. So what specifically, though? Why are you worried about it? Because I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum. I'm like, God knows what's going to happen, and I'm saved, so it'll all come out in the wash.
Whatever. Yeah. Unfortunately for my anxious thoughts is I'm not a Calvinist, so I don't believe in this predetermination thing where I'm totally set. So I always worry that I'm going to screw it up or I'm going to miss something or that was the mark of the beast. I totally got that. I didn't think it was that thing. I was a credit card. That was what it was. I guess I'm not going to heaven because I got the mark. So I have this legalistic mindset. That's another thing I'm trying to shed, but it stems from that. This legalism, this pride that says I've got to figure out the right way to do this. I can't miss anything in the eschatological things because I don't want to serve the beast or the dragon or whatever it is, depending on who you talk to, or Mystery Babylon and all those. Like, I got to figure out who all these players are so I don't accidentally lose my salvation.
Okay.
Because I would really hate to do that accidentally. Mm-hmm. And so all this, it's really weird, and it's almost like it's actually really a huge problem for me.
Okay, so we're going to actually have to
This is good.
Setting up some sessions, Jake, here, where I talk you through my Reformed theology and its applications for life. So, okay, but that'll come in the future. Brandon, what about you? You've kind of confessed a little worry in the past.
And now I'm worried about eschatology. Thanks, Jake.
That's all. Yeah, I'm never so thought glad about to bring that. Everybody else awesome. Into my a new worry crazy into my brain. Yes.
So I'm worried about you, Brandon.
Yeah. We're just bearing one another's burdens. Wow. That's what we're doing.
Awesome.
Okay. I feel so much lighter. Yeah. I feel so much lighter now knowing that Brandon is going to be bearing it with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do worry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if it's anything specifically. I think the biggest, before I left California, I always used to worry about getting trapped under a bridge in an earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
Because they used to have earthquakes.
Well, that can happen there.
And it really can.
Yeah.
Eschatology. Earthquakes and famines, man.
Right. See? It's all. But
it's lighting up.
I just tend to worry about future things. I don't know. I can't really pinpoint one specific thing, but I do tend to dwell on things and usually jump to the worst conclusion
possible.
So.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's, I mean, I think that's very common in a sense of, you know, I know I've talked with several friends where it's, in fact, I have gotten into fights with a couple of them where I'm like, you always like write the end of the book. It's like nothing's even happened yet. And you're already on the last chapter and it's a worst case scenario and, you know, whatever. So we've gotten into a few bickering sessions on that. All right, Catherine, what about you?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think for me in this season of life, I worry that I'm not being enough in like any area of my life. Recently, like it's been with my relationship with my parents, because I feel like I'm reading, like, so I'll read these books about like preparing for like marriage and the next season of my life. And then there's also books for like kids, like here's how you respect your parents. And I'm somewhere in between those seasons. And so I'm always like, what's my responsibility? Like, I feel like I'm just so worried that I'm not doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. And then like in other areas, I'm like, oh, but at the same time, I'm not being a great friend, but like I'm not being. So like I definitely like spiral into like the bad conclusion thing because I always feel like if I ever assumed something was fine and it wasn't, then I would just like never forget myself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's in a little way a kind of a worst case scenario thing. It's like you're worrying about things that you don't even know to worry about yet.
Right. That's I don't know.
You're worried that you're not worrying about the right things.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my
goodness.
Yes,
exactly. Wow. I'm worried that I'm,
Okay. What kind of things do you worry about, would you guys say, that are, I mean, there are some productive things to worry about. Like I would say, you know, we all need to be concerned about having a job, about being fruitful, doing things that matter, about, you know, caring for other people and stuff like that. But then there's also unproductive worry. And have you got, I mean, isn't it like, didn't I hear that stat once that there are really only 10% of things that you worry about that you actually have control over? And the other 90% is just completely out of your hands. And yet we put a lot of capital and energy and whatever into worrying about them. And as a result, they are leading to a lot of stress-related health problems and all this other kind of stuff. So what would you say are some of the things that you know you shouldn't worry about, but yet you do, and maybe eschatology is one.
It absolutely is that for me, because it becomes a paralyzing fear.
Yeah.
That's what happens to me is it becomes I get into this over-analysis where I find out about someone's new theory, and maybe I don't get into the like really crazy stuff, like the Hal Smith or whatever his name was.
And Lindsay?
No. Hal Lindsay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Hal Smith. I'm fusing Mormons with this other stuff.
Okay.
There probably is a guy named Hal Smith that does this for the Mormons. No. But for me, I can get into these conspiracy theory type mindsets where I've got to track down every loose thread and could it be this, that, or the other thing? And all of a sudden, I'm not doing my work. I'm not present with my wife or my kids or my friends or wherever I'm at. I'm just kind of consumed with, but what if, when there actually is wisdom from Jesus, both in Matthew 6 and in Matthew 24, where in Matthew 6, he's talking about don't be anxious about tomorrow because today's got enough for you to deal with. And then in Matthew 24, where he's literally just told the disciples about the destruction of the temple and all these kind of scary things that are going to happen in the future sometime. And then he says, but you know what? You know who a good and faithful servant is? Who just takes care of the people around him the way I've asked him to today. And that's directly from God. Every time he talks about the trouble he faces, he says, take care of what's around you today, the people around you today. And so that helps me when I'm facing those situations. It's like, is this something I can help with today, that I can take care of today? And if not, is it paralyzing me from taking care of things today? And that kind of has become my rubric for, is this healthy motivational worry that's causing me to work hard to provide for my kids and for my family? Or is this paralysis, you know, analysis paralysis, where I'm just not doing anybody any good at any point because I'm so anxious?
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Okay. Other unproductive worries and what you have or haven't done to tackle them?
I worry about like medical issues.
Okay.
Kind of And I think there's a term for that. People that have like a fear. And
hypochondria.
So, there it is.
Okay.
Hypochondria. Okay. And so.
You mean like stuff that's big, like you're going to get something big?
Right. Or you think, you know, you have like some pain in your side and it hasn't gone away in a few days. And so you go on to WebMD and
then you realize
you're going to die.
Like it's your version of, yeah, it's like I go online to see when the world's going to end. You're going online to see when your kidney's going to explode.
But WebMD always says like tumor. Like it's never like, oh, it's fine.
Have you guys watched Parks and Rec?
No.
At all?
Not really, no.
Where Chris Pratt is typing in someone's symptoms. He thinks he's going to WebMD. He's like, hey, Leslie, I typed in your symptoms, and it says you have network connectivity problems.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Anyways,
go ahead. So that's the big one for me, and then it just paralyzes you with, you know, every little twitch or every little thing that doesn't feel right. And so I just have to, number one, if you have something, okay, you know, it's kind of probably important to make sure you're noticing things that don't seem right, but a lot of it, I've found in my life has been just mental, you know, and then if I don't go and try to figure out what it is, just go to my doctor. It tends to work itself out. But there was a period of time where it was like every little thing, what's that? You know, and then it would be like, oh, great, I'm going to die. And then you're dealing with that for like a week and then nothing happens and it goes away. And I think the other thing that's been newer for me has just been as I'm getting ready to get married, just those things in the future. And you see different moral failures or you see situations in marriages that you go like,
never saw that coming.
Is that going to be me? You know? And so it's those things that you start thinking about.
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. I'm nowhere near getting married anytime soon, but it's the same thing. It's like, I see guys around me who have great intentions and they're all like living for the Lord. And I'm like, wow, like I'm so glad that I'm surrounded by like so many guys that are very passionate about the Lord. But then I'm like, and then I hear about middle-aged adults that make these big moral decisions. And I just picture them being that 20-year-old guy that had such great intentions. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, something happens and I don't know what it is. And I'm worried that not necessarily them, but also me, like that something happens that you can't control, I guess. But the other thing is kind of like your medical thing, except with relationships for me. I'm an assumer, you know? So like if somebody like does something differently, I'm always like, oh no, like that probably means this, which probably means this, which probably means this. And like, I mean, it's hardly ever true, but it goes back to me worrying that I'm not worrying enough. So like, I'm like, I'm probably not being a good friend. So she probably thinks I'm not a good friend. And it's pretty pathetic, honestly. Right. So, but yeah.
Well, it's funny because I was thinking about this in terms of my family because, you know, they're just one of my self-discoveries lately has been that my family's a lot weirder than I thought we were, like with a lot more quirks, some of which are borderline, I don't know, pathological problems. I don't know. But and I've got them too. You know, one of my things has been like worry about getting older, and I think some of that is just walking my mom through that process. Some of it is just seeing friends of mine that now their kids are like moving towards being grown, which I'm just like, didn't we just go to college together? What happened? And where did I get left behind? And then just feeling like, I mean, when I was in my 20s, I like laughed at this. Like the women who were just like, I'm just a has-been, I'm getting so old and whatever. And now I'm like, oh my word, I'm sitting there. It's so easy to just have the comparison game with everyone. So it's just nutty. But the one way I make myself feel better is I look at my siblings and I'm like, well, at least I'm not as crazy as they are, because they are like, I have sisters and brother-in-laws that will not fly, will not go on a ship, will not drive in large cities, and the things that they're doing in their lives now that are so limiting, it's like, how do you guys even live? Like, what in the world? Or they're afraid to, like, get an iPhone because they think that, or they'll make the excuse of, like, well, I'm afraid to get an iPhone because then it's just going to consume my life. And I'm like, no, your issues are going to consume. You know, don't blame the technology. Don't blame.
Your crazy is taking up all your time.
So anyway, it's just funny how we like to finger point and get caught up in this kind of stuff and take it too far, in a sense. But that said, and I referenced this article, it was from Science Daily, The Upside of Worrying. And did you guys find, I mean, basically it was talking about two things, worry as a motivator and then as an emotional buffer. So let's talk about it as a motivator. Where has worry actually been productive in your life? And, you know, you can call it worry or you can call it, like, I don't know what you want to call it, that's euphemizing it or whatever. But the motivational power of worry, what'd you guys think about the article putting that out there?
for me, that actually was part of what put me on a different trajectory in my college career. I was looking at doing, I was a political science major for my freshman year of college. And then I was kind of thinking, man, what kind of job am I going to get as a political science major? Am I limiting myself to a very narrow field that I actually don't really want to be in? And so, like, starting to have these second thoughts that you could say were a form of motivational worry of, am I going to be able to get a job or the type of job that I want in the career field that I want with this type of degree? And that got me started on the path of thinking, okay, maybe I actually need to look at a different degree program, and did cause me to change my degree and do a communications and media studies instead, because I thought that would make that sounded more in my vein and gave me a broader range of options. So for me, that was a helpful form of motivational worry that I've experienced.
Yeah, that's good.
Or I worry about feeding my kids and my wife.
Yeah.
And so that keeps me showing up to work.
I was going to say, helps you show up at work each day. That's
like
good.
If I don't come in today, I might not be able to feed my kids soon.
Mm-hmm. That is true. Yeah. I think some of the things I did in my past, the worry of possibly like backsliding into that, there's motivation behind not wanting to, just protecting yourself, guarding your heart to make sure that you don't kind of fall back into a old bad habit. So that, I think that part there is, and again, I see it just with, as I move into marriage, just with the way I've had some recent events kind of happen, not in my life, but just in my circle of friends, where it kind of gives you pause and you go, oh, wow, you know, it's good to worry about those things, because you just never know, you know, you can't, we're all sinful. We all fall short. And so I think it can act as that buffer between, you know, really just guarding yourself from going down a path or slipping back into a bad habit.
Yeah. I remember a friend telling me how she used to have a motorcycle, and she knew, and in part it was like her sister, you know, mentioned this to her, and some of it she just knew, but she was pretty reckless, and she just she doesn't have a lot of fear. And she just knew that, like, for the sake of her mom, for her sister, for her friends, for those who loved her, that she couldn't ride that motorcycle safely. And so she knew she had to give it up. And so she just loved, I mean, and it's not even that she didn't ride, you know, without a helmet or anything like that, but she would just get crazy. And she's like, you know what? This is probably not a good thing for me. And so having that, it's interesting to be able to look outside of yourself and see, you know, the both the benefits and the ramifications on other people to be able to do that as well.
That's funny, because I bought a motorcycle last semester and I've been a little too worried to learn to drive it.
Well, it's okay as long as you just sit on it in your driveway.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, take a picture for Facebook. Yeah.
Exactly.
Liam Mahogue.
Yeah.
We'll see. It's not Harley, no.
No, not that. Okay. And one of the other ones that it mentioned was worry as a buffer. I thought this was funny the way it described it, saying that, you know, being worried about certain things or having a healthy fear of things allows the good emotions that we feel to be heightened, in the sense of it makes us more positive about the things in life that are good, because we know realistically that there are bad things that can happen in life too. Mm-hmm. Has anyone had that experience in their life?
That was me before every single sporting event that I played in. I would be terrified at, man, I'm going to blow it. I'm going to do something terrible. I'm going to screw this up for the whole team. And then we'd play the game. That wouldn't happen. And I'd feel great afterwards.
Isn't it funny, though, how, like, you never learn from that?
It's right. The same still, thing a week later, it's Friday night again, and it's like, I'm going to screw it up. I'm throwing up on the sidelines because I'm so nervous about how bad this is going to go.
I did that, too. I was in debate in high school, and there was a season I threw up before every round. It was awful.
Terrible.
And then I, like, one time my partner and I won a tournament, and I still worried the next tournament. Like, I was like, oh.
Wow. I'm going to tell you guys, that just drives, like, optimistic people nuts. That is, there are some of us that are the opposite. We, like, going, oh, I'm going to do so awesome, and then we do terrible, and then we're like, oh, okay, whatever. So,
but then next time we're like, I'm going to own this.
We're going to totally be awesome. Yeah, it's absolutely different scenario.
Like,
so
that.
Too funny, but well, oh my word, we are out of time, you guys. This has been a great springboard to the discussion. Hopefully, you all will continue it over at the blog, because we love to hear from you guys out there in listener land as well. So worry, how has it played a role in your life? Has it been good, bad? What are the prolonged worries versus the temporary ones, the big ones and the small ones? We want to hear your take on it. So thanks, you guys, for weighing in.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, folks, for our culture segment this week, I get to welcome back our great friend, Max Lucado. Max, welcome to the Boundless Show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, the only thing wrong with today is that I didn't bring my mom. I know the last time I talked with you, I shared that she's your biggest fan. In fact, now she has dementia, actually, so she's older, in her 80s now. But she, so this is going to sound bad, but she loves, she will read your books aloud. And so I feel like I'm rereading a lot of your books as she reads them at home. And there will be outbursts of tears. There are outbursts of laughter. But you are blessing an 80 plus year old woman with your books here in Colorado Springs. So, and me as well. And speaking of books, you've written like a million. I don't even know. You've written, I think this is your 34th.
Some people shoot for quality. I'm just doing quantity.
Well, you are a great storyteller and wonderful at applying spiritual principles just to everyday life. And so that's right where our audience is, just needing some encouragement to get through the day and really trust God with our futures. And this one is no exception. We're going to be talking about your latest book, Anxious for Nothing, Finding Calm in a Chaotic World. And I was telling you before we started taping that, you know, kind of sadly, even young adults who we're talking to today have already had to deal with abandonment, anxiety, the feel over, you know, busyness, not knowing how to prioritize, not trusting when they should, when we should, I should say, throw myself in there. So we're really looking forward to you unpacking kind of some wisdom along these lines. And I want to kind of kick it off by throwing this out to you. You know, a lot of 20 to 30 somethings, we feel like we need to hold ourselves to a high standard, whether in jobs or relationships. How can we find the balance between high stress, overachieving, trying to have it all, and just an apathy or throwing up our hands and just saying, oh, what's the point? It's just going to overwhelm me anyway, or I don't even want to enter into anything like this for fear that it'll overtake me.
Yeah, you know, not all stress is bad. We point that out quite often in our conversations, and I tried to mention that in the book. And then also not anxiety. Living an anxiety-free life is impossible, even though the scripture that we're studying in this book is called Anxious for Nothing. It's simply not possible to live a life completely free of anxiety. In fact, I think what the Apostle Paul is saying through that passage in Philippians 4, a better transliteration would be, do not let yourselves be perpetually anxious about anything. So anxiety comes with life. I don't think it has to dominate our lives. And to get to your question, I think if we can have a healthy respect and understanding for anxiety, then we won't retreat from anything that might cause anxiety. And so that's the challenge. It's just to believe and understand anxiety is a part of life, but we can manage it in such a way that it does not have to dominate our lives.
Yeah. And to that point, one thing I want to kind of clear out from the get-go, because I know you helped make this distinction. Some anxiety clearly needs the attention of a therapist or professional help, possibly even medication. When so many of us deal with that, how can we tell the difference between the two when we might need either pastoral help or professional help on some level?
I think a book like mine is a good starting place. Any book on coping with stress or dealing with anxiety is a good starting place in terms of a first round. But if somebody has practical message on dealing with anxiety, you do your very best, you try to implement some of these principles, and yet you still find yourself battling insomnia or battling depression, then that's a cue that something is going on that needs you just need an outside source.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, you know, people whom I love, with whom I work, are treating their anxiety with managed medication. They're seeking regular counsel. The truth of the matter is, life is rough, and sometimes by the time we get ready to deal with some of these challenges, we're just a little bit imbalanced. Maybe we've been wounded in our life, or maybe even our, this is way out of my pay grade, but maybe our brain chemicals just need to be restored, that something's got off. And so I really hope people will not feel embarrassed or ashamed if they need to seek some special attention to deal with anxiety. But most of us, find a lot of help in dealing with the level that I'm talking about in this book.
Yeah.
And that's just some practical tools with dealing with anxiety.
Well, and I want to give people a sneak peek of what they'll find in this book. And one of the things, just the helpful things that you provide, is the acronym CALM to use when dealing with stressful situations and just kind of trying to start, you know, as a starting place to address it. Could you just walk us through briefly what those steps are?
I love acronyms because, as you know, I'm a pastor, and I get 30 minutes to try to give people a message that will stick with them. So I'm always looking for anything that's stickable. So forgive me if the acronym seems corny, but it does help. Again, this book unpacks the passage in Philippians 4 in which the Apostle Paul says, "Be anxious for nothing." And he begins that passage by saying, "Rejoice in the Lord always." So that's the C, celebrate God. Celebrate God's ability, celebrate God's presence, celebrate God's forgiveness. Let your mind off your problem and turn your attention to God. And then the Apostle Paul, when he says, be anxious for nothing, then he says, let all your requests be made known to God. So there's A, ask. Ask God for help. Treat worries like you treat a mosquito. Swat them immediately. Don't let them take up a residence in your heart, but quickly take them to God, and then leave them with God. The apostle says, let your requests be made known to God with thanksgiving. And so you're thankful because you can leave those requests with God. You rejoice in what God has done. You ask God for help. You leave those requests with him. But then the apostle is careful to say, meditate on these things. I like to think that because we have given God our concerns, all of a sudden, we have a lot of brain space that's free, and now the apostle's saying, now use that brain space for something good. Meditate on what is true, what is noble, what is virtuous, and gives us a list of things. But basically, he's saying, think about Jesus, because Jesus is all of those things. We get to manage what we think about. We get to pick what we ponder. So be careful. And so that's the acronym.
Yeah.
Celebrate God, ask God for help, leave your problem with him, and meditate on good things.
Okay.
C-A-L-M.
Sure. Okay. I think it's really great in the book how you do weave in stories and kind of tangible examples of just ways that we can latch onto these things. One of the stories I really liked was the story of your dad as you were growing up, something that he did every night when you all went to bed to indicate that the house was secure. Can you kind of tell us that story?
I wish everybody in the world could have met my dad. He just was the most likable man. He was a mechanic in West Texas oil field, not a car mechanic, but an oil field mechanic, and just such a likable guy. And he had this curious habit of eating or drinking, whatever you'd call it, buttermilk and cornbread at night, right before he went to bed. You can tell we were, I guess, country people. And he would do it in his boxer shorts and T-shirt. He'd come in the kitchen, stand there and before bedtime. By then, the boys were already in bed. All the kids were in bed. And so he would have his buttermilk and cornbread. And then he would walk around making sure everything was locked up. It was a small house, but he'd make sure the doors were locked and everything secure. Then he'd just say it loud enough for everybody in the house to hear, "Everything's locked up. You can go to sleep now." And, you know, that was an assuring thing. And that's really a picture of what it means to celebrate God. God is the one who locks up the house. God is the one who's in charge of this world. He's the one who has assigned himself the task of protecting us. Now, I think that a non-Christian can deal with stress, absolutely. But I think we Christians who believe in the presence of a loving, living and active God really have the inside track in dealing with stress, because our first thought is there's a good God. He's managing the world, and he's the one who tells us that everything is under control.
Yeah. Well, in light of that, I mean, I kind of want you to also talk a little bit. One of the things you draw out is just the bigness of God and how he is a God who is in control and can be trusted and is good. You actually say, I think you use the phrase that our biggest fears are sprained ankles to God. Tell us a little bit about why that is and the perspective that God has on our problems versus our own.
We in the book, I try to imagine what it'd be like to have a father who's a successful heart surgeon, and imagine being a middle schooler who twists their ankle and consequently can't go to the school dance. And when the father says, "I can fix you, I can help you," you say, "Oh, I don't think you can." And so the father says, "You come with me," and he shows you his diplomas. He takes you into the surgical ward. He shows you the books he's written, and then he says to you something like, "You know, I think I can handle a sprained ankle." And and the point is, our biggest problems are sprained ankles to God. That's why the apostle says, "Rejoice in the Lord always." The first step in dealing with stress is to stop focusing on your problem and begin focusing on God. The bigger God is, the smaller the problem will feel. Test this. Think about a problem, each and every one of us. We all have problems. What's the problem that's commanding your attention today? And then just think, can God handle that? Can he manage that? Is that outside of his strength ability? Of course not. So the minute you acknowledge that there is a God, a good living God, who can handle whatever this problem is, then you've got a leg up on that source of stress. That doesn't mean the problem has gone away, but it does mean that there is nothing fatal. There is no problem that can't be solved. It's going to be tough, sure. It's going to be a challenge. And I don't want to diminish some of the issues and challenges that we face, because they're severe. But listen, God is big. And so your first step in dealing with any source of stress is celebrating God. Focus on his sovereignty, on his goodness, meditate on his strength, and then you'll begin seeing that problem fall into perspective.
So here's one of those annoying questions that, like, you know, doubters ask. I'm sure people in your church come up to you and are like, please solve this one. So this whole idea as Christians, you know, we know that, you know, we know that Christ in our life should bring, I mean, there should be a correlation of peace and security. You know, we know the chorus, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is peace. So what about Christians that just constantly, you know, are not feeling peace or don't have an anxiety? Is that a sign that they should question their walk with God, or is there, are there valid questions to be answered there? How can they kind of, in a sense, trust the validity of their own faith in the midst of this?
I think that's a sign of something. I think it's a sign that they are human beings.
Mm-hmm.
All human beings struggle with anxiety and stress. You look at some of the best known Christians in the history of the world, you know, Peter and Paul and John, and just because they were in the presence of Christ, that didn't mean they didn't still have questions. They didn't mean they didn't struggle. The truth of the matter is, all of us are being shaped into the image of God, but none of us have been shaped. We're all still works in progress. And so let's don't add anxiety to our anxiety by saying, if I was a Christian, I shouldn't feel anxiety. The truth is, you will feel less as you grow in your faith. You will. But we grow and then we plateau. We grow and then we plateau. And then there's other challenges that come that are more severe. And so we're often tested. We're often buffeted. And then there is the fact that there is a devil, and this devil wants to take our joy, and he brings anything but truth. He just brings lies into our world. So it's a battle. It's a real battle. So I would say to somebody who is struggling with anxiety, I would say go easy on yourself. Just go easy on yourself. Be kind to yourself and recognize that you live in a fallen world. The presence of anxiety is not a suggestion of the absence of faith. It's just an opportunity for you to learn to place those anxieties in the presence of God. It's a development of the faith muscle. Mm-hmm. And so, I'd say don't beat yourself up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one of the things you talk about is certainly a source of anxiety for people is guilt, whether over present sin, past sin, mistakes made, opportunities lost, whatever. What are you say there are different ways that people actually handle guilt? Can you take us through a couple examples of those for people that may not even know? They may not even be aware enough to know that they're dealing with that.
Yeah. And I think this is an important part of this conversation. I looked at a dozen books easily on the theme of anxiety and worry, and nobody talks about guilt. Everybody just talks about stress or change or difficulties or challenges. But I believe that guilt, unresolved guilt, is a source of stress. Because think about it. If I feel bad about who I am, then I am going to get on a treadmill of performance trying to prove that I'm better. Or if I feel bad about something I've done, then one way of coping is to deny that I've done it, to cover it up. So life either becomes an endless cycle of performance or denial. And that then can easily lead to coping with this feeling of unsettledness through, I don't know, alcohol dependency or workaholism or a denial. Just a variety of things that I'll try to use to cover it up or to try to justify myself. And that's what's so beautiful about the message of grace. Guilt sucks the joy out of our lives. Grace restores it. Grace restores it. Because grace says, I acknowledge that I have messed up, but God has looked at my life from start to finish and chosen me anyway. He has accepted me. I am chosen by the beloved. I'm beloved by God. So that's a wonderful settledness that comes over to my life. I don't have to hide my sins. I don't have to perform to offset my sins. So those two you know, treadmills or those two roller coasters are immediately taken out of my life. Doesn't mean I won't sin, and doesn't mean I still won't have battles. But it does mean I acknowledge I don't have to hide it anymore. And number two, I don't have to make up for it anymore. Whew, if I can lift those two things out of my life, then a major source, a major cause of stress is gone.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. So, Max, as we close out here, tell us how, I think, you know, it seems to be very powerful the way that we as believers can encourage other believers along these lines. How can the body of Christ walk alongside one another to address the anxieties of the world, of our own sin, of just the stuff we're going through, so that we can kind of press through to freedom in Christ?
I believe honesty is the first place. We don't need to pretend we're somebody we're not. We're Christians. We're saved by grace. We're bound for heaven, but that doesn't mean we're not going to have fears along the way. And so we can be honest, and when we have a fear, we can share it with somebody. We can recruit a group of people to pray for us. That's what Jesus did. You know, yes, even Jesus had anxiety on the night before he was crucified. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he took Peter, James, and John to pray for him, pray with him. We can do that, and when we're in our own gardens of Gethsemane, we can have a group of people to pray for us. I think that's the reason God invented text messages. So we can, you know, alert somebody, say, man, I'm passing through a hard time. Would you pray for me? I've been through a major change just in the last few months. I was a senior minister for 20 years, and then I was teaching minister, and then all of a sudden I stepped back in as senior minister in a matter of a week, and I felt a lot of stress. And I found the best thing I could do was to turn to the staff and say, hey, I just need your prayers right now. I didn't need the added stress of trying to appear unstressed. So we can be transparent. We can pray for one another. But then we can assure one another that by God's help, he's going to help us. It's not his will that we be perpetually anxious. He wants us to be at peace even more than we do, and that's hard to believe. But yeah. He will help us. He sends his Holy Spirit to help us. So we can encourage each other with those words of hope. Hmm.
So true. Well, folks, the book is Anxious for Nothing, Finding Calm in a Chaotic World. We've been talking to the fabulous pastor extraordinaire and author Max Lucado, who, you know, we're forgiving him for being from Texas, but whatever. It's okay. It's all good.
It's not my fault. Take that up with God.
We'll just walk through the CALM acronym over that, you know, the people that are going to talk about their rivalries with various Texas schools and whatever. This has been fabulous and just a great primer for us, I think, to even wrap our heads around the fact that, yes, even as believers, we can get anxious, but we have a God who's bigger than all of that, and that we truly can, as the body of Christ, come before him directly and as a community to really be encouraged by one another. You can find out more about Max at maxlucado.com, and the book itself we're actually going to make available here at boundless.org. We want to get a copy into your hands for a gift of any amount to Boundless. You just go onto our website, boundless.org, click on the resource. You will get it there, and we will send you a copy. This is great for whether it applies to you or a friend or someone in your life that you feel needs to hear this message. Make sure you make it happen today. And Max, thank you so much for your years and years of ministry, as well as what you offered to our audience today.
It's my great privilege. Thank you. With the devil.
Well, hey, everyone. As we finish out the show, I get to answer this week's inbox question. So let me just jump right into it. Our listener says, I'm not a huge fan of online dating, but it seems necessary to meet people these days. I'll sometimes be contacted by men who sound like they might otherwise be a good match, but their relationship status is listed as divorced. I'm not sure how to handle responding to these men. On the one hand, they could be biblically divorced and we could be a good match. But on the other hand, I'm reluctant to spend a ton of time messaging them and becoming interested, only to find that their divorce was not for biblical reasons. But I feel like you definitely can't just open with, hey, thanks for the smile. What's the reason for your divorce? What do you think I should do? Well, this is a great question, one that is so applicable given how many of us are doing online dating these days. And whether it's a wink or a smile or a message or the initial, multiple choice questions on some of the sites, it is tricky to navigate that, hey, we're just acquaintances, but I need to find out some info about you before this goes too far. My short answer, I just tell it like it is, folks. I call it, I'm pretty direct. And so I would answer the whole, you can't just open with, hey, thanks for the smile. What's the reason for your divorce? I would say, well, you know what? You can. Now, what are you comfortable with? There's certainly nothing wrong with just bantering back and forth a little bit, finding out about this person. I agree with you that it's easy to get sucked in and then feel like either you've wasted a lot of time or worse, you become so attached to this person that you start compromising and you start writing off maybe very legitimate reasons that you should be questioning whether you should move ahead with this person. So go through the surfacey stuff first if you want to, if you're not comfortable putting it right out there to begin with. But I want everyone to be very direct and intentional in online dating. I don't want you to mess around. I have been there getting into trails that went on too long with guys who I had no business talking with based on stuff that they either did answer or weren't willing to answer, probably even worse, being kind of shady about it. So see if there's even potential based on the initial conversations that you have, and make sure to just watch your heart and have your friends in this with you so they can help you navigate this. Do not get carried away emotionally. Do not start telling your whole life story in an inappropriate way. And sooner rather than later, this guy needs to explain his story, at least the overarching plot of it. I would even go so far, and this is, I don't think this is too much to ask. I would even go so far as to ask him to connect you with a pastor who can vouch for him and for his story, or pastor, an accountability partner, an elder in his church, a mentor type person, someone, just show that he is in community. I think most people who have walked through divorce, they know why they're divorced. And for those that really were divorced biblically, they have a reason for it, and they're willing to tell that story. And they're willing to be above board, because in online dating, it is necessary to be careful and to know the type of person you're dealing with, because you do not know this person and you're not in community with them where they can be vouched for by other people. So do not be ashamed to ask for that. Be gracious in asking for it. Don't be all judgy and weird. And don't, start making accusations before you know what's up. But be direct and be honest and just say, I'm searching for a life partner, and this is very important for me biblically and what I know I want to live out in my faith. I want to be careful in this area. So it's a tricky spot to navigate, but I applaud you for wanting to do it well and wanting to be open and honest and really convictional in the way you pursue a dating relationship with someone, knowing that you don't want to be grieving the Holy Spirit or sinning by entering into a relationship that shouldn't be. So hopefully that will help you as you walk that path. All right, well, that's it for this week's show. And remember, this week's show was sponsored by Evidence That Demands a Verdict, the new version by Josh McDowell and his son Sean. So check it out. Go to readevidencechapter.com. Do write to us at editor@boundless.org if you have questions about this week's show, or if you have a question to submit for a future show, and hop over to the blog so you can be part of the conversation. We will see you around next week. I'm Lisa Anderson for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.